What if the biggest threat to your company's 2026 revenue isn't, your competitors, but the code sitting quietly in your own app?
Right.
Code you literally paid an outside vendor to write. Welcome to the deep dive.
It's a terrifying thought, honestly.
It really is. So today we're focused on a topic that might look like standard corporate strategy on the surface, but it's actually fundamentally about protecting your business from massive risks you probably can't even see right now.
Exactly. The hidden stuff.
Yeah. We are unpacking a highly detailed internal strategy and SEO planning document. It's called the 2026 Software Development Partner Evaluation Scorecard.
And it's an incredibly revealing document. I mean, it's written specifically for founders, executives, product leaders, basically anyone who is currently staring down their 2026 roadmaps.
Right.
And what makes it so compelling is that it completely dismantles the traditional vendor selection process. It kind of forces you to realize that hiring a software partner is almost never about finding someone who just, knows the right programming language.
Exactly. I mean, the honeymoon phase of a vendor contract is full of mood boards and wireframes and all these big promises of digital transformation.
Oh, yeah, the flashy stuff.
Right. But this document cuts right through that. So, okay, let's unpack this. Before we can even talk about how to mathematically score a potential partner, we really have to look at why so many of these partnerships just crash and burn.
Yeah. And the source material makes a really bold claim right out of the gate. Most organizations do not struggle because they lack technology or tools.
So wait, if it isn't a lack of tools, what is actually breaking down mechanically behind the scenes?
Well, the real friction comes from behaviors that are completely invisible during the sales pitch. We're talking about vendors who habitually overpromise on their delivery timelines, or they underdocument their code.
Which is a nightmare later on.
Huge nightmare. And, terrifyingly, they skip proper quality assurance or QA testing, they hide technical debt, and ultimately they leave the client without true ownership of the final product.
I want to pause on technical debt for a second, because that's a term thrown around in boardrooms a lot, but I feel like it's rarely understood.
Oh, absolutely.
Mechanically, what does that actually look like in the code? We aren't just talking about a minor glitch, right?
No, not at all. Technical debt isn't just a bug. It is a structural compromise made for the sake of speed. So imagine a vendor hard coding a specific temporary workaround into your checkout flow just to hit a Friday deadline.
Okay, sure. Just to get it out the door.
Exactly. And it works on Friday. It might even work for a year. But 2 years later, when you want to switch to a cheaper payment gateway, you realize the vendor didn't build a modular integration.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. They essentially superglued that single outdated payment provider into the core architecture of your app. That's technical debt.
Wow.
And unwinding that superglue, that takes hundreds of hours of highly paid developer time.
It makes me think of buying a house. You walk in and the living room is beautifully painted. You know, the staging is absolutely perfect. So you sign the mortgage.
Right. It looks great on the surface.
Yeah. But what the vendor didn't tell you and what you didn't know to look for is that there are termites in the foundation. The fresh paint job is the flashy user interface, but the termites are the skipped QA and that hard-coded technical debt.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
But here's what I don't get, and I have to challenge this premise a bit. If these issues are so destructive, why don't business leaders see the cause immediately? Why does it take 2 years to realize the house is falling down?
Well, what's fascinating here is how a business will naturally, almost organically, mask its own system failures.
Really? How so?
The source material points out that these hidden technical issues manifest as customer experience problems. You know, a slow app, confusing interfaces, drop transactions.
Right.
But leadership rarely sees that raw failure because employees step in to act as human duct tape.
Human duct tape. That's a great way to put it.
It's so true, though. When the software fails to generate a report, an analyst spends 4 hours manually compiling the spreadsheet to bridge the gap.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Or when a customer's order gets stuck because of a database error, a support rep uses a manual workaround to push it through just based on their memory of how to fix that specific glitch.
So they're just quietly fixing it behind the scenes.
Exactly. Leadership only sees the final result. The report was delivered. The order was shipped. The root cause, which is the failing vendor architecture, stays completely hidden behind the manual exhaustion of your own team.
Until it scales to a point where human effort just can't patch the holes anymore.
Precisely.
Wow. So your own employees are basically holding up the sagging floorboards themselves, and their hard work is actively masking the termite problem from the executive team.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening.
But when your own team is exhausted from manually patching over a vendor's bad code, the whole model is broken. You can't wait until the system buckles to find out your vendor skipped quality assurance.
No, you really can't.
You have to force those hidden flaws into the light before you sign a contract. And I guess that brings us to the first major structural shift in the document phase one of the scorecard.
Right. The document stresses that phase one, which is evaluating the partner, must be narrow enough to be actionable, but comprehensive enough to expose those termites.
Okay, what does that look like in practice?
Well, it lays out very specific criteria. You aren't just asking if they can build an app. You must score them on their system architecture, their code quality, their internal security processes, their communication cadences, IP control, testing rigor, and post-launch support.
I want to dig into IP control really quick, because that's another one that sounds like legal jargon, but is actually a massive operational risk.
Huge risk.
Right. Lacking IP control isn't just about legal copyright. It's like paying someone to build you a custom car, but they legally own the only set of keys to the hood.
Exactly.
You get to drive it, sure, but the second the check engine light comes on or you want to upgrade the battery, you are legally forced to pay them exorbitant rates just to look inside your own vehicle.
That is a perfect analogy. I mean, if the vendor retains control of the source code repository or the core intellectual property, you don't have a partner. You have a landlord.
Oh, man. A landlord.
Yeah. You are essentially renting your own business infrastructure. And the scorecard is designed to identify that exact dynamic before you sign.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, the scorecard also demands that these evaluations be grounded in credible external standards, specifically citing OWASP secure coding practices.
Yes.
Why is it so important to anchor this to an external acronym instead of just saying, you know, make sure it's secure?
Because secure is subjective, right? OWASP stands for the Open Worldwide Application Security Project. They provide objective, globally recognized standards for secure coding.
Like what kind of standards?
Well, like specific rules for how software should validate user input. This prevents a hacker from just typing code into your search bar and downloading your entire customer database.
Yikes. Yeah, you definitely want to prevent that.
Right. So by anchoring your scorecard to OWASP, you remove the vendor's ability to say, well, our internal security standard is fine. It forces objective accountability. If they don't follow OWASP, they fail the scorecard. Period.
Okay, I have to push back here, though. IP control, OWASP standards, post-launch support. It all sounds fantastic in theory.
Sure.
But isn't this just another generic checklist? The kind of thing executives look at once in a Q3 planning meeting, nod their heads at, and then completely ignore when they actually go to hire a team because they just want to get the product out the door.
That is exactly the trap the source material is trying to help you avoid. The document is incredibly strict about this.
How so?
The output of phase one cannot just be a meeting. It must be a documented improvement. You have to establish a tangible, current baseline of where your organization stands today.
Okay, so like a snapshot of the current mess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What is the current code quality? Who owns the workflow right now? Which systems are currently integrated? If you do not have a documented baseline, you will never be able to mathematically prove if the new partner actually improved anything or if they just maintained the status quo.
That makes total sense. I mean, a baseline only matters if you actually measure against it correctly. And reading through the next section of this document, it's glaringly obvious how many companies are tracking the completely wrong things once the vendor starts working.
Oh, yes. Phase two of the scorecard tackles this head on.
Yeah.
A very common, very expensive mistake highlighted in the source is measuring activity instead of measuring outcomes.
Right. Activity versus outcomes.
This is a massive distinction. Publishing a new web page, buying a fancy new continuous integration tool, or holding a bi-weekly sprint planning meeting, these are activities. They do not prove success.
They just prove that the vendor was busy.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Measuring activity over outcomes is like bragging about buying expensive running shoes instead of actually running a mile.
Yes.
You looked the part, you spent the budget, you've got the moisture-wicking shirt, but you haven't actually gone anywhere.
That is spot on. And the business world is full of companies just admiring their expensive running shoes. The source details exactly what outcomes should be measured instead.
Okay, so what should we be looking at?
We're talking about tangible business metrics. API response times, conversion rates, risk reduction, fewer customer support tickets, better search visibility, stronger lead quality, and cleaner operational reporting.
I'm looking at this list of metrics, and it strikes me that a vendor could easily manipulate something like conversion rates by just buying low-quality traffic.
Sure, they could.
Or they could manipulate response times by temporarily turning off background features. How does measuring something like API response time actually prove a partner is delivering structural value?
That is a phenomenal question, and it really gets to the heart of why these specific metrics were chosen. Let's take API response time.
Okay.
If you measure an activity, the vendor says, we built the database integration. Great. But if you measure the outcome, the API response time, you might see that a database query takes 4 full seconds instead of 400 milliseconds.
Oh, wow. That's a huge difference.
Right. Mechanically, that reveals that the vendor didn't index the database properly, or they wrote incredibly inefficient, bloated code. You aren't just measuring speed. You're using speed as a diagnostic tool to reveal the hidden architecture. Bad architecture is slow. Good architecture is fast.
The outcome metric forces the underlying truth to the surface. But knowing the response time is dropping doesn't automatically fix the server.
Sure.
You can have the best dashboard in the world, perfectly tracking your outcomes, but if no one is contractually obligated to act on it, it's just a screen flashing red on an executive's wall.
Exactly right.
And that structural gap is what phase three of the scorecard attempts to close.
Precisely. This brings us to what might be the most vital structural shift in the entire document: ownership.
Ownership.
Yeah. The source insists that treating partner evaluation as a single one-time task is a massive error. Evaluating a software partner cannot be something you do in June and forget about by August. It must become a repeatable, continuous operating habit.
And to make it a habit, the document mandates standardizing ownership. So once a project is live, someone has to own the maintenance, the reporting, the vendor coordination, and the future updates.
Yes, absolutely.
But the source material doesn't just say assign a project manager. It insists on this highly specific two-owner system.
Yes. Internal alignment is the bedrock of this phase. The document requires one business owner and one technical or marketing owner.
Okay, so how do they split the work?
The business owner's job is to define why this matters, what the overarching revenue or operational goal is. The implementation owner, so the technical or marketing person, defines the practical mechanical steps to get there.
Okay, wait a minute. Why two? Doesn't splitting the responsibility just create a classic corporate scenario where everyone points fingers when things go wrong?
It definitely can.
Like, the business leader says the tech failed to deliver, and the tech leader says the business goals were completely unrealistic given the legacy code.
That's a valid concern, and I mean, it happens all the time in poorly managed companies. But the genius of this specific two-owner approach is that it acts as a structural counterbalance. Think of it as a built-in translation engine.
A translation engine. Walk me through that.
So if only the business side owns the vendor relationship, the project becomes too abstract. It's all high-level vision, ROI projections, and no execution.
Makes sense.
And the vendor can easily hide technical debt because the business owner doesn't know how to look for it. But if only the technical side owns it, the project becomes deeply buried in technical minutiae.
Right. They get lost in the weeds.
Exactly. They might spend 6 months perfectly optimizing a feature that customers don't even care about, and leadership has no way to evaluate the return on investment.
Right. You don't hire two owners to simply share the workload. You hire two owners because they speak fundamentally different languages, and the project will die if it isn't constantly translated between business and tech.
Yes. They keep each other grounded.
The business owner ensures we are actually running the mile, and the technical owner ensures we aren't running it with a sprained ankle.
Exactly. The pairing forces constant friction, but it's productive friction. It keeps the project anchored to reality.
So we have our dual owners in place. They know how to translate between business goals and technical reality. But how do they get the money to actually fix the problems they uncover? Let's talk about the final piece of the puzzle: budgeting, documentation, and local context.
Well, when it comes to budgeting, the document offers a deeply strategic approach. You must strictly separate your urgent fixes from your maturity improvements.
What's the difference?
Urgent fixes are the immediate fires, things actively affecting security, causing downtime, or violating compliance. You don't debate those, you just fix them.
Got it.
Maturity improvements are the strategic upgrades that make a system stronger over time, like building better reporting dashboards, automating manual workflows, or establishing stronger data governance.
But getting executives to allocate budget for maturity improvements is notoriously difficult. I mean, if the system technically works, executives rarely want to spend money just to make it mature. How does the scorecard say you should pitch that?
The primary budget discussion must shift entirely to focus on the cost of inaction. Instead of pitching the cost of the fix, you pitch the cost of doing nothing. You force leadership to look at a highly specific scenario.
Give me an example of that.
Let's say the cost to automate your reporting system is $50,000. Leadership balks at the price tag. But the cost of inaction. You have three senior analysts spending 20 hours a week manually compiling spreadsheets from three different vendor platforms.
Ah, the human duct tape again.
Exactly. Not only are you burning $100,000 a year in wasted payroll, but the risk of a human copy-paste error could lead to a massive compliance fine. When you frame it around the objective, operational cost of doing nothing, prioritization suddenly becomes incredibly clear.
It's forcing them to see the termites in the budget. We can ignore the foundation to save $50,000 today, but the floor will collapse in 6 months, and that will cost us $500,000.
Yep, that's the exact conversation.
And to make sure this isn't just a one-time revelation that gets forgotten, the document heavily stresses documentation and accountability.
Yes. You need a practical checklist, a short summary of decisions, and a verification log. The goal is simple. If a new team takes over next year, they shouldn't have to restart the discovery process from scratch.
Right. They can just look at the log and immediately understand what was done, what was deferred, and why.
Furthermore, the source dictates that external partners must provide plain language reporting.
Oh, I love that part. Leadership shouldn't have to decode a giant wall of technical jargon just to figure out if the project is on track.
No, they shouldn't.
If the vendor can't explain their progress in plain language that connects directly back to the business outcomes we talked about in phase two, that is a massive red flag. They are either hiding something or they don't actually understand your business.
Precisely. And this ties directly into why the document anchors these strategies to specific, highly competitive business environments, specifically mentioning Orange County as a prime example.
Let's contextualize that because it's a really important inclusion. The document grounds this framework in hyper-competitive local markets like Orange County. Why? Because in a saturated, high-wealth local market, user patience is absolute zero.
Oh, definitely. Zero patience.
If a local healthcare portal, a real estate platform, or an e-commerce site takes 5 seconds to load, or if the user interface looks slightly insecure, the user doesn't wait. They go to the competitor down the street. A hyper-local market ruthlessly punishes slow digital front doors.
Exactly. The margin for error in those environments is razor thin. You cannot afford hidden technical debt when your competitors are just one click away.
And that's why the source material connects this operational alignment to highly specific implementation tracks like Technigene's custom software development, startup software development, and secure software development services.
Right, it's not one size fits all.
You can't just throw generic outsourced code at a competitive market. It has to be custom fit to the business logic, built for rapid scaling if you're a startup, and locked down with rigorous security protocols. The document provides a clear path from identifying the risk to actually securing the right kind of implementation support.
Yes, it really bridges that gap.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, as you look toward 2026?
It means resetting your expectations of what success looks like. The strongest signal of success in this framework is not finding a flawless vendor. The document is very clear on that. The goal is controlled progress.
Controlled progress. I like that. It means leadership can sit down at the end of the quarter, look at the plain language report, compare it against that documented baseline we talked about in phase one, and definitively mathematically say, yes, our API response times are faster, our lead quality is higher, and we are objectively better today than we were yesterday.
That's the ultimate goal. It transforms the act of evaluating a software partner from a vague, stressful guessing game into a tightly managed business capability.
With clear accountability.
Yes, clear accountability, deep visibility, firm internal ownership, and measurable follow-through.
I want to do a quick recap of the journey we've just taken. We started by realizing that technical debt and skipped QA are the invisible termites destroying your customer experience and tanking your conversion rates.
We did.
We learned how to build a phase one scorecard that relies on real external standards like OWASP, ensuring you keep the keys to your own IP and moving way past generic checklists.
Right.
We explored phase two, where we absolutely must avoid the trap of measuring mere activity. We stopped bragging about buying the running shoes and focused on actual outcomes like API response times that diagnose the health of the underlying architecture.
Yep, outcome over activity.
We implemented the two-owner system in phase three to build a translation engine between business vision and technical reality. And finally, we locked it all in by forcing leadership to confront the cost of inaction.
It is a comprehensive, rigorous blueprint for 2026. But looking at all these requirements, the continuous internal ownership, the dedicated documentation logs, the deeply integrated two-owner translation engine, it leaves me with a somewhat provocative thought that wasn't explicitly mentioned in the text, but really feels like the inevitable conclusion of this entire framework.
Oh, really? I'm intrigued. What's the takeaway?
Well, if evaluating and managing a software development partner requires this level of deep, continuous internal integration, are we witnessing the death of traditional outsourcing?
Oh, yeah.
It really seems the future isn't about handing off a scope of work to a vendor, tossing it over the fence, and just walking away. It's about building a permanent hybrid ecosystem where the boundary between external partner and internal employee completely dissolves.
Wow. If you have to manage them this closely and integrate them this deeply into your own business metrics, they really aren't an outside vendor anymore, are they?
Not really, no.
They become a permanent load-bearing extension of your own foundation.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. It's time to take a hard, honest look at your own vendor scorecards for 2026. Are you actively inspecting the foundation of your digital house, or are you just admiring a fresh coat of paint? Are you tracking the miles you've actually run, or are you just buying really expensive running shoes? Catch next time.